Mount Sinai in the previous time. Oh, you're the only three. So all of us are new. Right. Well, let me start by saying that, look, I've been in Providence since 94 and chaired committees for 11 years. But in the last 5 years that I was, so to speak, serving the executive, I think there have been some changes. I'm just coming from a meeting now with a unit manager. But my own feeling is that, look, we should stick by, as far as possible, the way this committee operated in the past. Unless there are reasons to make fundamental changes, you know, in the sense that broadly, the broad approach of the committee. What we used to have before 2009 was, I don't know whether this still happens, there's a multi-party management committee to meet now and then between committee meetings to discuss things. You can even have, if you like, something can be mulled over. Maybe two from the ANC, one from the EFF. We don't have to formally meet necessarily. We can even have a conference to discuss some management issues. Something maybe you want to think about. Does that still happen then? We had it in the committees that I always chair.
I think the proposals are a big improvement.
proposal we've just made, and I think I will definitely support that. I think it's an excellent idea. Not how I'm mind to that, I'm just saying, but obviously every decision that's taken has to be done by the committee, obviously. That's more process. Sorry, you want to say something, was it? Nothing. Okay. And so we then all hand over to, I think Alan, you're presenting the legacy report. Sorry, Jen. You can't introduce yourself. We should come back to you. I'm just interested to get a sense of the skills that we have and experience relevant to the portfolio committee. So if you want to say, if this, you know, we all said what we did. I can tell you now, I don't have any experience of the finance committee. It's completely new to me. And so on and so on. So maybe tell us a bit about yourself. We'll come back to this program.
All right, thank you very much, and apologies for being late, Chair. I was held up in another meeting, but my name is Kambayomsi Kwankwa. I'm the chief whip of the United Democratic Movement. My background is in banking mainly. I'm an ex-relationship manager at Absa Private Bank. Worked there for many years before I joined politics. Well, I don't like talking about my credentials, but a qualification that would be relevant, in particular for the finance portfolio, is that I hold a degree in business administration and an honors degree in economics, and this is my master's degree in economics. Thank you very much.
Finance, yes. I studied at Stellenbosch and I did 2 years of articles and returns firm. I then went back to the Free State, bought several buildings. I'm still paying down the bonds. There's quite a few buildings. I think I've traded a lot of work in my life. Yes, I have a couple of centers, flat buildings, etc. So definitely a small businessman with ambitions, with a view to create a lot of jobs for people.
Yeah, I think the latest skills are very interesting and quite relevant to the committee. I'm surprised in a sense that we have such a wide range of skills that are relevant to this committee. Right, over then to you, Alan.
Thank you, Chairperson, morning members and colleagues and staff. I'm Alan Wickham. I am the Committee Secretary for the Standing Committee on Finance at East Wallaby. My colleagues will introduce themselves as we go along. Today I'll be presenting the mandate of the committee. I won't go into great detail because in the latest presentation with the Budget Office, they will go into much detail with regards to that. Then the role of myself as the committee secretary, and then just a brief summary of key points of the legacy report from the previous committee or previous board. Okay, the mandate of the Standing Committee on Finance, it was established in terms of sections.
Which document are you speaking to? Which one? Is it the orientation paper? Oh, the slide presentation.
The committee was established in terms of Section 4.1 of the Moneyball's Amendment Procedure and Related Matters Act. The mandate of the committee is conferred to it by the Constitution, guiding legislation, standing rules, or resolution of the House, including consideration and report on the following. It's the National Macroeconomic and Fiscal Policy, amendments to fiscal framework, revised fiscal framework and revenue proposals and bills. Actual revenue published by the National Treasury and any other related matters or matters set out in the bill. Furthermore, the mandate of the committee or the committee's function is to legislate, conduct oversight on the executive's actions and its entities, and the bill, the MT Money Bills Amendment Procedure and Related Matters Act, shall I say, makes provision for procedure for this committee to amend and bills. The role of myself as the committee secretary, this is by no means all we do, but this is basically in our performance contracts, is provide procedural advice to the committee, overall coordination of committee activities, for example, calling team meetings, also setting up committee meetings, processing amendments to bills, cashing and drafting committee minutes, drafting of reports, implementation of committee decisions, general record keeping, ensure development of term and quarterly programs in line with the annual plan, ensure that the committee's budget for their activities, and also to monitor the budget of the committee. Then we move on to the legacy report. What you see on the slide is just an overview. The purpose of the report was, or is basically, to provide an account of the committee's work during the fourth parliament and to inform members of the new parliament of key outstanding issues pertaining to the oversight and legislative program of the Department of Finance, that's National Treasury and all its entities, and also statistics, South Africa was that to say. The report provides an overview of the activities the committee undertook during the fourth parliament, the outcome of key activities, as well as any challenges that emerged during the period under review, which was in the fourth parliament, and issues that should be considered for follow-up during this term of parliament. It also summarizes the key issues for follow-up and concludes with recommendations to strengthen operational and procedural processes to enhance the committee's oversight and legislative role. I also just want to add that in the packs that you have, there is a detailed report, legacy report, the full report is in the pack. Key statistics emerging from the fourth parliament, the table you see there basically is broken down into years, from the start of the term to the end of the term. The final column is the total. Meetings held, legislation processed, that's from bills to acts, oversight trips, study tours, as you'll see there's no study tours undertaken, and that's also a recommendation that the committee should consider that. International agreements, by that it's tax treaties, double taxation agreements, those sort of things. Statutory appointments made. The only one made during the fourth parliament was the appointment of the director of the parliamentary budget office, which will probably be here a bit later on. No interventions considered, and also no petitions considered. Key challenges that the committee encountered was limited time to process legislation and reports referred to the committee. Documents prepared by the department pertaining to complex legislation was really technical, and the committee felt that it should be designed for easier comprehension by members. They were also of the view that the department should submit a list of legislation that it intends introducing into parliament for the committee to process during its 5-year term, just so that there's better planning involved in all the processes. The need to enhance sector-specific skills and experience through training interventions within the committee to enhance the committee's oversight capacity. Knowledge of the processes and procedures pertaining to the work of committees within Parliament should be made clear to all members. That should be through members training, things like that. The technical and operational challenges that were encountered related to constraints created by the parliamentary program at times did not provide sufficient time for the committee to comply with time frames in terms of the Money Bills Amendment Procedure and Related Matters Act. That basically just the days specified in the legislation was sometimes a bit challenging just because of the way the program was designed. Recommendations from the fourth Parliament Finance Committee was to enhance coordinated legal and research support structures for members so as to ensure the effective day-to-day functioning of the committee, thus enhancing its oversight capacity. The establishment of the Parliamentary Budget Office for the fifth Parliament, which was actually established during the fourth Parliament, but leading on into the fifth parliament, the committee felt would add great value in this respect. The committee felt that any vacancies within the unit should be filled as a matter of urgency, and the unit should be sufficiently capacitated to assist the committee in its day-to-day work. sector-specific and ongoing skills training should be offered on an ongoing basis for the benefit of the committee, specifically when dealing with technical legislation, that's tax legislation. Those interventions should be considered before the committee deals with any legislation of a technical nature. The committee should also have a legal expert available when dealing with such legislation. And I also just want to add that for the probably the last year of the fourth Parliament Committee's existence, that such an intervention did occur where National Treasury normally, or SARS normally held a day or two workshop when it came to tax legislation, fairly technical tax legislation. So that's probably something that can continue. The committee should ensure that its legislative plans and processes are currently shared with the department as well as with Parliament as a whole to ensure that there is alignment of plans and processes between all stakeholders. Recommendations continued. It's also the last slide. The committee should prioritize and plan a detailed overseas study tour with a view to observing the processes followed by other legislatures in considering fiscal frameworks, budget processes and the methods employed by some of the committees of other legislatures in performing oversight over designated entities. In the fourth Parliament, there were quite a few attempts made for this, but just due to unforeseen circumstances, was always cancelled or postponed, and the committee felt that it should be important for this committee to undertake something like that. The committee felt that there's a need for proper planning and alignment of the parliamentary program and activities of the two houses of parliament in conjunction with the department so as to enable the committee to comply with the legislative processes in performing its oversight work. The process should be guided by the strategic plan of parliament. And finally, the Money Bills Amendment Procedure and Related Matters Act. There was a House resolution the Money Bills Amendment Procedure and Related Matters Act. There was a resolution passed by the House. As far as I know, that was to continue during this Parliament. The legal advisor, Advocate Jenkins, would be in a better position to answer any questions related to that. That was the amendments that the committee was considering. It was around time frames in processing the fiscal framework and revenue proposals and such. And that's basically my presentation. Thank you.
Alan, you allocated time that you sort of allocated time basically to your input, but not to questions. Presumably, whoever's making input should make allowances for any questions and comments. So over to members.
Thank you, Chairperson. I just want a bit of clarity on the Moneyballs Amendments and Related Matters Act. I was in the committee when it was originally written, and we were very mindful of the fact afterwards that the time frames were very, very tight, and we saw that when we tried to implement it effectively, it was a bit of a difficulty. I see that you've got it written down there, but I really do think that we need to have some clarity on it, because I think that's quite an important thing. In fact, it's probably a lot way out there in importance, and have we got some plan on that? Thank you, Chair.
Not only on the executive section and entities, but especially on the entities. And perhaps the lack of oversight. In the past, we've called several times and several letters were written to the chairperson with regards to the oversight on the FSB, Reserve Bank, the Land Bank, and the GEPF on very serious and important issues, and it never materialized. I'd just like to note that this should be a priority.
Just on the outstanding issues, it will also be important for us to be aware whether some of the business that is outstanding from the previous term are they not going to impact negatively on this current budget process? And what is it that we can do to make sure that there's alignment and that as we play oversight, some of those things are taken care of, because it will be very important for us to deal with that. I've seen on the outstanding issues, there are also things like budget office and other things. Are we able to do them now so that some of the things we're able to put systems in place and make sure that that happens, including the issue of vacancies? Because I've seen it as you were presenting, that it's an issue of vacancies and so on. And I think if you look at what the chair said last week on the sector-specific training sessions, I think that's really worth online, because I see it as one of the things that we have to focus on, and saying that it's one of the programs that the chairperson spoke to as one of those. And so it will be very important for us to start to identify, you know, between now and the end of the year, a few training sessions that we think can be relevant to the committee and start to plan around those. Thanks.
Do you have any proposals in mind on what should be aspects of the training program?
Well, there's a presentation that was made during the workshop. I can't remember that professor, but I think he was very good. The one that presented on budget, was it? Yeah, the one that came with Advocate Jenkins last week during the week in one of the budget process. And I think he can be relevant to us on some of the things that we think are very critical and pertinent to the community. Thank you.
Thanks, Chair. Let me start by welcoming a brief presentation made by Ellen. But then the first thing that maybe I should clarify is on the issue of the budget office. This is a fairly new structure, and we are aware, as honourable member have just cited, that through the induction workshop, they made a presentation to all of us. And what came out clearly out of that workshop is that there's a lot of progress that has been made in that office. And of course, there are still challenges in terms of ensuring that the full staff complement for the site unit is realized. But fortunately, if you look into our program for today, we will be having a briefing specifically, I mean, to entertain what are the challenges, or maybe what are some of the strides that the site office has been made, because the approach is such that this is our committee, or maybe the finance family, have been placed at the helm of championing the establishment of this office. So it comes, I mean, to the responsibility of the finance committee under your leadership, Chair, to ensure that most of the issues that will be raised maybe in their presentation are taken forward. And the second issue, the issue of the money bills, correctly, as Dr. George has said, this is a bill that, I mean, this particular, it's an act as we are speaking. Now, it has been referred to the finance committees under our leadership by Parliament after realizing the time constraints that members are referring to in as far as our budget processes are concerned. Now, there was a committee that was established of chairpersons that was working with the House chair around this issue. And this committee did its work. But unfortunately, because of time constraints, I mean, they couldn't complete their work. I think the simple suggestion that one can forward to this sitting is that maybe through you, Chair, that committee need to be revived, because that was the committee that was championing this process of ensuring that there is alignment, but also issues of child pressures that currently exist in the current legislation are dealt with appropriately. So I think it will be important that we through you share such a structure is revised, because as Dr. George correctly cited, this is something that is very, very urgent. And obviously, it will continue to give us some challenges. But as you could see, I mean, we are really working under serious time pressure to conclude on budget processes. So it's a given that we haven't yet addressed the problem. So the problem is still sitting with us, and we are looking forward to the resuscitation of that committee of chairpersons, I mean, so as we are able to bring a conclusion to this important aspect. I think those are the two that I wanted to bring to the discussion.
Before we move on, how far does this committee get? Because it is finished its work, they do a report, and it's just that the report wasn't like implemented recommendations. So where was it when it came to an end of the work?
If my memory serves me well, I think there were some areas of disagreement, and they are still looking into that, more especially around the timing as to when what must happen. But the details are there. I mean, pardon? There was no report. The only report that they presented to the House was the report of extension, the request for extension of time, since they were looking into some of the aspects of this act. You know.
So what I'm saying is, if we new members are going to start off from where they left off, is there no documentation?
No, that's it. There will be documentation. Yes.
All right. So was that shared in the open committee meeting?
Yes.
So why don't we ask Ellen to give us, you know, as soon as reasonably possible, the last report or summary, so that the committee members are acquainted with what happened in the past? Do you think that's probably possible? Do you think there's some better way? I'm open to any proposals. Do you want to say something?
Yeah, no, that's an order, Chair. But one point that I wanted to bring to the attention of the House. This is one area where, because from time to time, there will be a need from our side to work with other finance committees, including appropriations and the select committees of the NCOP. Because if you look, one of the things that we strive to realize in the past, the parliament, was to ensure that we work together with finance committees in the NCOP. You know, so I think that's in order, but ultimately, there will be that need of us having a joint sitting around this meeting, because that's how it was dealt with. We had joint meetings with all finance committees to deal with this matter.
I see meetings of the chairs, and you also had one or two, maybe more meetings of the committee.
All committees.
Yes, yes, of course. Yes. Okay, good. So you put that together, Helen. Okay. Now, do you want to respond to any of the issues raised? When I say you, I mean the whole team. We are all well respondents.
Thank you, Chair. I think Ms. Van Rooyen covered everything. It's just that the oversight and the entity that the committee looked at, unfortunately, that was out of my control, so I cannot give the committee an answer on that. What the previous committee did was they only took the main entity, in that case being Treasury and SARS being what it is, fairly big entity, they looked at that as well. But they did realize the need for the committee to spend time with other entities. Just also with regards to the Money Bills Act, Advocate Jenkins, I think, would be in a better position to take the committee through, because the Financial Management of Parliament Amendment Bill, that was the piece of legislation that was extensively dealt with in the committee. As far as I know, there is an amendment from the NCOP that needs to come to this committee, the standing committee. That has not been referred to the committee yet. The other piece of legislation that was outstanding was the Development Pact of Southern Africa Amendment Bill. And in that
Now, obviously, for this particular budget review, given the time constraints, there's no choice. I mean, as I understand it, they have to submit our reports by the 11th next week. I mean, it's impossible. It's a very special set of circumstances. We're just not going to be able to do anywhere near what we should be doing. But certainly, we should create a firm foundation for next year doing the budget review. Very rigorously and exhaustively. On the issue of the training, that is part of what I suggested last week was that we give ourselves 4 to 6 weeks or so to get a better sense of what the issues are within our portfolio and then shape a broad 5-year program within which the elements of annual program can be done. But we can, by the end of this session this morning, have elements of the program begin to emerge in the way they're already doing so, right? Right, so I think we're done for this section. I don't know if somebody else wants to say anything very quickly. Yeah.
So on training, well, of course, these short training or short courses are encouraged, job relevant training is very much appreciated, but also there are provisions within Parliament for academic development of members. And what came to my attention the last time is that such provisions are not appropriately popularized or taken advantage of. Now, I would suggest to the committee that maybe members who really want to pursue such particular path, they must let us know so as we are of assistance, because at times some members do some of these things on their own, they struggle. They are assigned from pillar to post. I mean, to realize after 2 years or a year that a member is struggling just to register with a tertiary institution. You know? So I would suggest that, I mean, for our committee, if members really are interested to pursue, let's engage so as we see how to help. Because the unfortunate part is that there is just a committee within Parliament of administrators that is assigned this responsibility. And from with our little experience of the past Parliament, where members find it very difficult to derive joy from such a thing. Maybe at our level politically, we should find a way of assisting members, those who want to pursue such.
Does anybody have information in regard that you could give members? Is there like a document or something that tells you?
What I suggested to them is that they must develop a browser of all opportunities available to members, so you can share it with our members in all committees. Because they only had a table during the induction, but they did what they call skills for it. But they didn't give an outline of what are the opportunities that are available for members.
Would it be appropriate for Alan to get information that's available for people in this committee who want to train themselves in the areas relevant to this committee?
Correct.
Alan, can you hear that? Well, I mean Alan, I mean your whole team. Okay. So there we are. That's done. The second item is content advisor input on the annual budget process.
First, just to explain what a budget is and the importance, and then the legal legal framework, the role players in the budget cycle, the cycle itself, and where we are currently. A budget is a tool that translates policy into service delivery. It is a process through which revenue gets allocated to the 3 spheres of government. It's a process through which cash resources are allocated to competing needs. As we would know, South Africa has the highest number. South Africa is one of the countries with the highest level of inequality, irrespective of the measure that you use, whether you use the Gini coefficient or the Thiel index or any other measure. So the budget becomes a tool to redistribute income and wealth and for development in the society. In terms of the legal framework, the fiscal oversight framework is based on the constitution, the PFMA, the MFMA in terms of the local sphere of government, and the Money Bills Act. The constitution gives parliament a mandate to scrutinize and oversee executive actions to ensure accountability. In the constitution, that you will find under section 55, 92, 114, and 113, just for everybody to go through that, I did not mention the specific sections here. And also, in terms of the oversight process, that would be in sections 213, 14, and 215. And secondly, the PFMA also regulates the fiscal oversight. The Act was passed to ensure that financial management of both the national and provincial spheres of government, the key objective being to ensure transparency, accountability, and sound management of financial affairs. Specifically, Section 27 states that the minister must table the annual budget for the financial year in the National Assembly before the start of the financial year. That's where we are right now. Section 27.4 as well requires that the accounting officer of each department must submit to Parliament measurable objectives for each main program in the department budget vote. These are the updated strategic plans that are going to be tabled tomorrow by our relevant departments, National Treasury, SARS, and FFA. I just put the MFMA, it does the same thing as the PFMA, but at the local government. And then there's the Money Bills Amendment Procedure and Related Matters Act, shortly or popularly known as the Money Bills Act. Now, this is a very important act for the Committees on Finance and Appropriations. The Standing Committee on Finance has been established in terms of this act. The act provides a procedure to amend money bills before Parliament. It was enacted to give effect to Section 77 of the Constitution, because prior to that, Parliament could not amend money bills. Section 4 and 15 of the Money Bills Act provide for the establishment of the Committees on Finance and Appropriations and the Parliamentary Budget Office, respectively. I think Alan also has spoken about the section that would be I think it's Section 4 in the Money Bills Act, which states that the Committees on Finance must report and consider on the macroeconomic and fiscal policy, fiscal framework, revenue proposals, and on the actual revenue published by the National Treasury. And in the Money Bills as well, so the processing of the budget vote that's currently before the committee is also indicated in the Money Bills Act, Section 10C. That the relevant member of the cabinet must table the updated strategic plan for the department which must be referred to the relevant committee for consideration and report, just to give the members the background in terms of where we are currently in terms of the legislation. Role players in the budget cycle, I've just listed all of the relevant stakeholders in the budget cycle. Committees on Finance and Appropriations, OPA, National Treasury, National Department, AG, FFC, Parliamentary Budget Office, and the Civil Society. When we adopt the fiscal framework, we also do public, we invite the public to comment on the budget, so that's what we mean by Civil Society. In terms of the budget cycle, the annual budget cycle and the milestones, in February, the President gives the State of the Nation address. The Minister of Finance will table the national budget together with the budget review and the estimate of national expenditure and the fiscal framework. This committee would then consider and report on the fiscal framework. That's the process that was done in February, March this year. Currently, between March and August, Parliament passes the Division of Revenue Bill and the Appropriation Bill. These two bills, they confirm the allocation of funds of each board. So the Division of Revenue Bill was passed. The Appropriation Bill is now before the Standing Committee on Appropriations, and our role as the Standing Committee of Finance is to process or deal with the updated strategic plans or APs, annual performance plans and budget votes of our relevant departments and entities. And between September and November, that's after this process, the committee will submit the budgetary review and recommendations report. It's called the BRRR report in Parliament. And in October, the Minister of Finance will table the medium-term budget policy statement together with the annual report. So this is what's coming for the committee between September and October, November. I've spoken to this slide. So where we are right now is that the scope is short for Standing Committee on Finance. This committee passed the fiscal framework in March. The appropriation bill, as I said, is with the Standing Committee on Finance on appropriations. And then tomorrow, the strategic plans will be tabled before the committee. And this will then be referred to the committee for consideration and reporting. The portfolio committees are responsible for exercising oversight of the legal performance of departments and entities. After the evening tomorrow, the committee should process this budget vote and report by 11 July. In terms of the document for budget oversight, just to assist members, the relevant document would be the State of the Nation address, sector relevant documents, national budget documents, the Division of Revenue Act, the budget review, the appropriation bill, the updated strategic plans and APPs, Auditor General and SCOPA reports, and any other relevant reports. Alan can make these documents available to the members. We just didn't want to give members everything, all the information in one go. That would be the end of the
session. Thank you. Just a quick comment. Well, while people are mulling over what they want to ask, possibly may I ask a question? This public participation on the budget, how does it normally occur? Now, obviously, it's ruled out for this particular year, but what usually happens? You mean you have public hearings on the budget? That's the question I want to ask. I want to be clear.
there's a slide that spoke to role players. I think I see the one on documents, the role players. Those are the, is at the center of the activities of this committee. Should I take it that way, Alan? National and provincial departments, and I'm not sure whether on provincial departments we're only looking at provincial treasury or whatever, and all those other entities. Are all these activities and role players things that this committee has to deal with? And if that is the case, what happens after the Minister of Finance has passed the budget? Do you have those public hearings like what normally provinces would have, just to engage stakeholders before, does it come before or after the Minister has passed the budget, something around that, so that one has an understanding, something that relates to what the Chair has just asked. Do we have those public hearings before, or do we have them after?
Thank you, Chair. Let me start with the role players question, and let me also clarify that this presentation was meant to be standard for the NA and SDOP. That's why in my previous slide you saw MSMA. This committee has nothing to do with MSMA. But the Select Committee on Finance, my committee would have more to do with it. Same applies to provincial departments. The committee does not deal with provincial issues. They are in the NCOP. So my apologies for not amending the presentation to suit only this committee. The AG Chairperson is also same explanation. In the Select Committee, the Auditor General is the key stakeholder because we need to know how funds were spent and whether the provinces and municipalities are complying with the relevant legislation, etc. On the question of whether the money bills was ever amended, I think the short answer is no, not to my knowledge, mainly because there was no capacity or limited capacity to amend the money bills. Hence, the establishment or fast-tracking of the establishment of the budget office to also assist the committees on finance in amending the money bills going forward. On the question of public participation, and Alan, you can also assist me. The minister would table the national budget normally, and then the following day, the minister would brief the four committees on finance and appropriations. And the next week, a week after, then the committee would have public hearings with the stakeholders. Regular stakeholders during the public hearings for this process would be your Chamber of Commerce, your Manufacturing Circle, the SAICA, SAIT, the tax institutions, FFC, and the like. I think I've covered all the questions.
Thank you. I also just need some clarity. We always have the SONA, and then of course we have the budget that gives effect to the information address. And then from there on, the normal budget cycle. But in terms of the election that is taking place, exactly how does that change the budget cycle? And is that related to the updated strategic plans for each department and public entity that now needs to be revised in terms of the election and the change scenario? Normally, in terms of the BRRR, as you know, then later on we have the recommendations in the BRRR, which is very important. But with the elections that have taken place, in terms of change, the strategic plans, how does that affect the budget cycle?
Thank you.
of the budget cycle, there will probably be changes which will be eminent from the medium-term budget policy statement time, because firstly there's new portfolios that would have to be factored in. The structure of committees has changed. Those new departments will need to be overseen as well. But usually what happens is that, for example, in the research unit, the researcher who deals with small business, we would ask them during the RRR process to, small business is not a new thing. It's a new department, but it's not a new thing. Small business has always been, SMEs have always been part of the government priorities. So they would go to the Department of Trade and Industries previous documents and source out anything, all information regarding small business for that portfolio committee, so that the committee knows, you know, in terms of continuity, what has been the policy, what has been the policy regarding ensuring SME growth in the economy. So although there are new portfolios, although the budget structure will change, the END will change, and sometimes you find that a program has just been removed from trade and industry or local or economic development and incorporated into the new department. It might be for valid reasons such as strengthened management oversight over the budget. And you know, the change is in terms of where government is going, and whether we can trace the changes back to the NDP. I don't think there's a lot of change, but there will be implications in terms of capacitating committees to actually ensure that the new portfolios, we can track them back and see what the progress has been and where we should go in terms of policy. Thank you.
Right.
I think, Chair, one of the things that become critical to this committee is the issue of the strategic plans and APP, monitoring and planning oversight. And normally there's malicious compliance by departments with regard to APPs and strategic plans. It will be very important for us to be taken through on key issues around APPs and SPs. So a training program of a microwave kind of for this committee will be important. You can microwave us quickly because the APPs are now going into, they will be going through the chamber because the minister will be passing the budget very soon. But it will also be very important for us to be taken through on what to look at on the APPs and strategic plan, so that as we play oversight on what has been appropriated and all these things, and especially what pertains to us as the Committee of Finance, will be critical. And those two documents are very important. And training around those on what to look at will be very, very critical across all of
the
areas.
We didn't turn, I think, attention to this later this morning, but we are considering the reports tomorrow. So we're talking of an long-term training program that we can hear. Now, I just wanted to check something. On the public hearings we have, do you put an advert in the paper
into that tailing of the budget as it will now. They are your normal or your standard tax practitioners, PwC, those places that are pretty much penciled in for every time. I know it used to be a practice a couple of years back for the committee to invite certain stakeholders. That's been stopped. It's only now advertised. But all the stakeholders are normally aware of the process, or they are aware of the process. I may also just want to add that Moneyball's never been amended. It is not a matter of just amending. There's a whole process, and I think the budget office can probably give a better detail on that. There's a whole process involved in order to amend the Moneyball, and the time that the committee has in order to pass, any Moneyball, there's normally not enough time. I would say that was probably, and also the resources available to the committee's disposal, that was basically the main reasons for the committee not amending any money goals.
Yeah. Okay, but I just think we should come back to this question of the nature, scope, extent of public here on the budget. We've got a year, what is it, 9 months, or short of 9 months to think about this process, on how we manage to make sure more effective oversight and more public participation. Okay, this is not something we need to discuss now. You want to say something other than I'm just worried about how we manage the time, because we're on item two and you're about to break the team. So I'm guided by the meeting. What are we saying? Can we have more points to reply?
Just finally, the committee also considers written submissions from stakeholders, so they don't necessarily need to be here. Yeah.
Trying to re-emphasize that the issue of the time pressure in this whole budget process is at the center of this money being referred to the finance committee. So generally this is a problem in the SSA picked up even by the parliament. So that's why this thing has been referred to the finance committee.
I'm suggesting that there's a lot of overlap with the next item, right? Item 4. By the committee secretary and the budget officers, and item 3. Is that right, Alan? So what do you want to add on item 4? Should we move on to item 5, or do you want to break the tea? Is the tea here already? Do we know? All right, meanwhile, why don't the content advisor deal with sector analysis quickly, and then somebody will check if the tea is here and what's going on.
Thank you, Chairperson. The purpose of this presentation is just to give an overview of the current development before the committee receives the detailed budget analysis of the National Treasury, SA and SARS. The presentation would look at the global economic development, the recent developments in South Africa, some policy pronouncements and the implications thereof. This table compares the GDP projections in January 2014 and the latest ones in April 2014. As it can be seen on the table, global economic activity registered 3% in 2013, supported mainly by export rebound in emerging market economies. These are largely Brazil, China, India, and Russia. And these are the IMF, International Monetary Fund projections. What I want to highlight in this table is the performance of the South African economy versus Sub-Saharan Africa. In 2013, the SA economy grew at the rate of 1.9%, if you compare it to 4.9% of Sub-Saharan Africa. And also to note the changes between January and April this year only. If you look in the last column, the change was supposed to be the change in 2014. The IMF has revised down the GDP forecast for South Africa by 0.4 percentage points. If you check the 0.7 percentage point, 0.4 of it is coming from South Africa. So that's potentially what I want to highlight, that we are trailing behind our peers in Sub-Saharan Africa. And also that the world GDP was revised by only 0.1 percentage point. This is just the slide I've spoken partly on the slide. The key drivers of world GDP are expected to be reduction in fiscal tightening, except in Japan, and the highly accommodative monetary policy. That's all I wanted to highlight on this slide as well. If you look at the domestic economy now, I've chosen a few of the forecasts from various analysts, the IMF, the World Bank, the OECD, Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development of East South Africa is a member, the South African Reserve Bank, the BER, Bureau of Economic Research, the rating agencies, and the National Treasury. If you look at the table, this column, on average, in January, December, February, the South African economy was projected to grow at 2.7% on average in 2014 and about 3.4% in 2015. And if you look in the last column, it shows the revision, downward revision of the forecast by various analysts. In total, on average, by 0.7 percentage points. Much of it is coming from the BER and the Fitch rating agency. Now, during the national budget taking in February 2014, National Treasury expected the South African economy to grow by 2.7% in 2014 and by 3.2% in 2015. The assumptions given by the National Treasury were that the introduction of new power plants and transport infrastructure was going to boost the SA economy. Also, it was expected that stronger global recovery would support exports, and growth in Sub-Saharan Africa was expected also to promote expanded trade and investment. As it is, we don't have the latest National Treasury forecast. They will probably come during the MTDTF taking in October later this year. However, there have been some developments in the domestic economy post the national budget tabling. In the first quarter of 2014, the economy contracted by 0.6%. This was largely due to production losses in the mining and manufacturing sectors. As I have indicated also, most of the analysts have revised their forecast down as at April, May, and June, depending on who the analyst is. On average, the economy now is forecast to grow at 2% this year in 2014 and only expand to about 3%, 2.93% in 2015. mainly growth is expected to be supported by stronger external demand. Now, all these analysts have given various reasons why they have revised down or reduced their growth forecast. All of them have cited prolonged platinum strike activity as the main reason. We know there are structural constraints or bottlenecks in the economy, including electricity supply constraints. And the third one, the third reason indicated was largely the fact that the South African growth outlook has deteriorated since January this year. And another reason was the risks posed by the strike action on the fiscal consolidation plan. In addition to that, in April this year, the Reserve Bank hiked interest rate by 50 basis points, and there is a possibility of more interest rate hikes from now onwards. That has constrained the consumer spending environment, and currently the unemployment rate is at 25.2% as at the first quarter of 2014, up from 24.1% in the third quarter of 2013. I've also indicated there that the strike disputes in the platinum mines have since been resolved recently. That might assist the economy to grow in the second half of this year. And what does that mean? Essentially, is that the economic environment has changed since the taking of the national budget. The outlook may have deteriorated. South Africa continues to grow below potential, pointing to the fact that the economy is susceptible to external shocks. And as it is, the economy is not creating enough jobs to absorb new entrants in the labor market. All these factors have implications for the fiscal. Now, what are the implications? South Africa adopted the counter-cyclical fiscal policy approach, where during times of recession, government would increase spending to support some social programs as well. And during the economic boom, the government would reduce spending. That policy response to the global economic crisis resulted in a large budget deficit. And the deficit remained persistently high as revenue and growth forecasts are repeatedly revised downwards. It was expected that the deficit would narrow from 4% of GDP in 2013-14 to 2.8% by 2016-2017. That was based on the assumption that economic growth would pick up pace and therefore revenue collection would also increase. But the situation has since changed. More implications of the credit rating agencies downgrading South Africa are that the cost of borrowing for businesses and government would increase, and that is likely going to increase the debt servicing costs. But the net national debt is still expected to stabilize as a percentage of GDP in 2016-17. I think it's going to be around 44% of GDP. That also means that the fiscal space has been eroded by the rising debt. Having said that, the policy pronouncements, as indicated in the NDP, the budget review, and the SONA, are that government would prioritize implementation of the NDP. SONA also acknowledges that the economy needs to grow faster than the current rate of 1.9%. implementation of the infrastructure program, a wide range of job creation initiatives, ETWP community work programs, the jobs fund, the employment tax incentive bill that was passed late last year, earlier this year, the SMMEs transformation of the energy sector, and recognition of the importance of partnerships and collaboration. Now, in terms of fiscal policy, government remains committed to maintain fiscal sustainability and to reduce the debt levels. And therefore, the fiscal consolidation path will continue, and the commitment to reduce budget deficit will also continue. In conclusion, I think it is important to note that the economic outlook has deteriorated from where we were in January or at the time of the tabling of the budget. Growth is expected to be modest. Some analysts are already predicting negative growth rate in the second quarter as well, given that the factors that led to contraction in the first quarter always also continued into the second quarter. That limited the scope for a growth rebound in the second quarter. However, as I indicated, the platinum strike has been resolved, and it is expected that GDP would recover in the second half of the year. If the electricity plans go as intended, then that would provide a positive supply shock, which could also boost growth in the economy, and also implementation of the new ways to deal with the market and labor market issues may also assist. Also to note that the current fiscal stance has been modeled on growth forecast of 2.7% in 2014, and that has been revised by various analysts. The key risks, or the key risk to the fiscal sustainability, is economic uncertainty. That's not the only one. There are others, but this would be the key. Thank you.
Comments. Obviously, this is a major issue. It's going to preoccupy us for a long time to come. This is just a quick fleeting overview in preparation for tomorrow's consideration of the strength planning budget of the department. Comments? Questions? Right.
Comments on National Treasury, the GDP projections for April to June not being available. And I think if I understood you correctly, and you said it would be through June available only in the medium term budget policy. Yeah. What would the reasons for that be? Is that a normal practice, and why is the projections not late? So is it, normally there's a Treasury projection on this specific time frame. Thank you very much for being here.
Thank you. I'm saying, to my knowledge, we get National Treasury forecast during the national budget tabling, and I have checked. I haven't seen them anyway. So I'm thinking the next time that we will publicly get to know about the changes to the forecast will be during the national during the MCT as well. I stand to be corrected.
Well, we can ask in the second half of the sitting this morning, but they'll be here tomorrow. You can put the question to them why that's the case. Is the case. Okay. I just wanted to alert members to the fact that ESTA is actually the Select Committee's content advisor. And I take it, whatever our differences on the nature of the current economic challenge, on
this meeting unanimously decides, there's no need for a seconder, that we want Esther or we want another Esther. Any objections? No. Agree.
One issue, and thanks to the in-depth analysis that our content advisor has just given to. If you look at the budget deficit analysis, and the, there's also an issue of the cost of servicing the debt. I had thought in one or the other, our content advisor was also going to show us whether going forward revenue collection will also come as a mitigation towards some of the challenges we're facing. Is it working, is it not working, and what makes it not to mitigate on some of the factors that affect us?
We can also read tomorrow, but for now, Esther, your reply.
Revenue collection efficient SRs maybe depends on the economic conditions. If the economy is not growing as it should, as it is currently the situation, then chances are revenue collection would be affected. So, yeah, that's in short.
Do you want to say something?
Maybe it's an advertisement that we should discuss in great detail in a different meeting. In slide number 7 there, about what are the reasons for reduced growth forecast and everything, I think this recurrent misdiagnosis of what constrains South Africa's economic expansion. And that is what we need to discuss, because we tend to focus on superficial issues that day. Because even if those can be dealt with, even if energy can be dealt with, and the strike ends and all those other things, possibility is that the economy will not expand. So we need to do a thorough diagnosis of what constrains the South African economy, why is it not expanding. Qualitatively and quantitatively. Those are some of the things that we must look into, because failure to have a proper diagnosis of what constrains growth, it's going to lead to misapplication of what are the remedies. And that is the biggest mistake made in the National Development Plan and made even in the previous economic policies of what have been our progress, because we really can't say that there was a period since 1994 where we realized or witnessed buoyant economic growth, which was a result of industrial expansion. It has mainly been the changes of commodity prices and all these other things that contributed magnificently. And also the obsession with creating conducive conditions for foreign direct investment. Let us just be open, attract as many investors as possible. I think that we are betting on the wrong horse altogether, because FDI has never been more than 4% of the overall GDP in South Africa, and everything else that we do, our economic policies and everything else, is about that. It's about saying, no, we must create these proper conditions for investors to come. They won't come in a way that we need to deal with the unemployment crisis that is facing the country. So we need to deal in a more detail. I think that let's deal with parties and politics and make a thorough analysis of what constrains growth and industrial expansion in South Africa, so that we then come with proper solutions, because what we're doing is superficial issues. when it was accused of the sin of guilt at the religious church. It was something else, and superficial issues, we're not looking into the deeper structural issues that characterize our economy. Those are things we must deal with more substantially, and we'll come with a more sustainable solution in terms of our move forward. I will discuss this in great detail, Chair, in this meeting, maybe.
Maybe, we should. Firstly, the research is giving a sort of fleeting overview. I don't think even she thinks that these judges are panacea, that I say the word panacea, the answer to all the problems. I think also that the ANC is talking about looking at the structural constraints of the economy. I think your party would disagree by the extent to which the ANC sees about it and what it means by it. And that you're right. But certainly the ANC goes far beyond the four observations here, and I think it's taken a first look at that. We also acknowledge this is not going to be a full list. I think that what we're moving towards is in the next 6 weeks or so looking for maybe if we can pin people down for like a day or 2 day workshop when you look at all of these issues. So it's not that you may discuss it. It's your right to request it, and it's a reasonable request. If we do all of these four things, my own personal view is that it will spur growth, but it will not meet the needs of the masses of our people, nor even the objectives set out in the NDP. I agree. But exactly to what extent these four things and other things will help is something we need to discuss. And I think that's on the agenda as an NDP support. And we should look to a date in mid-August at the latest. By the time we've met all the parties here and got a feel for the various entities that fall within our portfolio and so on, we should have our own workshop and invite a range of speakers from different perspectives also to give us their views, and also we engage ourselves rigorously around the issue. So I agree with you, Floyd. I don't think anybody disagrees. We need a more thoroughgoing analysis, I think, as well. So again.
Yes, very much in concurrence with the submission. But I think I must also caution, because one of the biggest challenges that this committee is encountering, as earlier showed in our latest report, is time to do all these things. Now, my request, Chair, and my humble caution to honorable members is that let's not defer matters. When there is a platform like this, because we have researchers, we have contact advisors, and we are here also, let's engage on issues and clarify issues, you know, because defending at times might never come. I'm just forwarding this simple warning.
I thought what we're agreeing on, but if the majority disagree with me, I'm cool, is that we're all not on the same page. Some of us are maybe new to this portfolio committee. We haven't met. I read in the public domain about the financial services board, but I don't even know what it does exactly, personally, and I don't know exactly what our role is and so on. So it's a bit too soon to start looking at a full-blown discussion that Floyd Shivambo is putting on the agenda right now. This is a fleeting overview of some of the issues that we will be tackling tomorrow. And we can't discuss the issues for anything here. And it would be inappropriate until we get a better feel, as most of us are new to this committee, including people who are not here. So, you know, beyond the first 3 months, then it's easier. So we're not deferring anything. We're choosing the most productive moment to engage on it. But if the majority disagree and you want to have a discussion now, let's do it. So what do you want? Yeah.
Chairperson, I think today is mostly about orientation and having a brief discussion about, you know, general information on where our
have to recognize our limitations, not just of time, but also capacity. You know, we don't even have, as I said a moment ago, a content advisor fully fledged attached to our committee. So we have to take all those considerations into account. What I'm suggesting is that people mother this around the middle of August, we do have a one-day workshop towards maybe once every 6-8 weeks, spending a day looking at the broader strategic issues. And sometimes we have I don't know how Parliament's rules allow for it, but a closed, it's not a meeting, a closed workshop, where you can have a frank discussion. That has been done. It's not a committee meeting looking at policy decisions. It's a closed workshop where people are free to speak their mind. So these are things that we can mull over, and within 4 to 6 weeks now we're going to make up our mind. There's not going to be endless mulling here. We're going to move. But the first 6 weeks or so, as I see it, till about August or so, is the finding of the feed period, if you want to call it that. And within 3 months is the strategic agenda for 5 years, within which is an annual program. Those are reasonable time frames. Bearing in mind that some of us are very new to this portfolio. So these are things we need to discuss. The majority party needs to meet in its own study group hopefully tomorrow evening to decide its views on these issues, which could guide the chair on how some of the things might be done. So in short, I think it's time for tea, and I'm not sure that we need 15 full minutes for that, but what about 10? Thank you.
Okay.
comment here. And I will start with the National Treasury analysis. And in terms of that analysis, first starts by stating that the mandate of the National Treasury, which is to support economic growth, to promote good governance and social progress, foster accountable, efficient, and sustainable management of public finances, and as the custodian of state funds, the Treasury works within the fiscal principles of counter-cyclicality, intergovernmental fairness, and debt sustainability. Now, in terms of the broader macroeconomic and fiscal policy, what broader government aims at is to ensure that we manage revenue and expenditure effectively. Government aims to limit the cost of service delivery, and in that regard, we want to eliminate wasteful expenditure. And we also want to prioritize improving value for money, thereby spending, targeting our spending on policies and programs that increase our development. Government has been spending a lot on infrastructure, and there's a lot of infrastructural and social spending. But the Treasury has stated an explicit expenditure ceiling that should not be exceeded. Now, in terms of the 2014-15 financial year, it's 1 trillion. The expenditure ceiling is set on main budget estimates. And the challenge there, because we do have an expenditure ceiling that we have set, would be to strike a balance between cost containment and service delivery, as well as monitoring the capital spending and capital transfers that government is spending on. In terms of policy priorities as well, the table indicates where the most budget increases are. And if we look at the table, we would see, for example, that the main increase is on employment and social security, which increases by 12.72% in real terms. And following that, there is a 6.9% increase in debt service costs. And local government and housing, community amenities, that will be evident as we go down through the presentation. The first row, defense, public order and safety, decreases in real terms, and a question there would be, what is the impact, for example, in terms of oversight? I think the defense committee and the police committee would also wonder, what is the impact on service delivery and crime prevention if the defense, public order and safety cluster collectively is going to experience a decrease. And in terms of education and related functions, the education, that budget also decreases in real terms. And as we go down in the Treasury vault, we will see that transfers to higher education institutions are going to be affected significantly. The general public services, that is in line with saving, identifying savings and where government could save and cut costs. In terms of strategic priorities, now we zoom into the department's budget. In drawing its budget, the department has to look at work within those broader policy implications. They want to prepare, finance, and publish the national budget. We see that when the department publishes the estimates of national expenditure, the budget review, the Appropriation Bill, the Division of Revenue Bill. They want to improve techniques to monitor and analyze public expenditure and to ensure appropriate use of public resources and to contribute to improved capacity in financial management. The support for infrastructure and urban development is quite important. And government also wants to enhance supply chain management processes in government. In the National Treasury, there is a Chief Procurement Office. And procurement and supply chain management is one of the important objectives because it's a big area where government can look out for fraud in terms of procurement practices, but also in terms of ensuring that government gets a fair deal with business when they procure. In terms of the department's economic classification of expenditure, the broader government aim, according to the Minister of Finance in his budget speech and the budget review, is to maintain tight control of the goods and services budget and to effect cuts on travel, catering and consultants. The current budget is 23% of the budget. Most of it goes to transfers, and 99% of that is on interest on land. In terms of the goods and services budget, most of the budget goes to consultants and business services and computer services. In terms of both all three presentations, National Treasury Funds and FSA, when the previous committee would ask them about their consultants' budget, they would allude to the fact that there are really scarce skills, finance skills in the economy. And sometimes they have to go with consultants because they need certain skills which are not available in the department and they can't compromise on economic policy, for example. The interest on land budget, as mentioned, increases a lot. That's what the table indicates. What does increase is travel and subsistence quite significantly. When we go to the FSA presentation, we'll see that travel and subsistence increases, and that's probably because they have to do field work when they do their censuses and when they collect data. They have to be a constant stream of labor coming in to do those statistics. So it will differ from department to department, but I think that it's important for the committee to check why is your travel and subsistence budget still growing? Is it justified or not? And then in terms of transfers, you would see that transfers, 77% of the department's budget is transferred to different entities. Public corporations and private enterprises increase, their budgets increase a lot by 81.35%. The national in the budget review, the Treasury has alluded to that and they said that they want to improve monitoring over these entities because a lot of the infrastructure transfers are going to them. They use the word improve. So I think because this committee oversees the Treasury, it would be important to say what needs to be improved. Where are the gaps in your monitoring mechanisms? Are there challenges? And just to check that, because these entities are the implementing agencies, that the Treasury is keeping track on how the funds are being used. The higher education institutions budget, as mentioned previously, the Treasury's micro budget matches the consolidated budget because transfers to higher education institutions decreased by 45.39%. It might be an issue for the higher education and portfolio committee And I think this is one of the areas where it would be important for committees to work together, because that committee works with the sector issues pertaining to higher education specifically. They would know what the impact would be in terms of service delivery. They would have the history of expenditure and service delivery in that department. And I think that in terms of the finance issues and appropriations issues, as well as COPA, there is maybe a gap in terms of how the appropriations and finance committees and COPA work with portfolio committees in order to get to a clear understanding of what is happening in the sector, as well as with treasury, with financing. The capital expenditure will mostly be spent on intangible assets, software and intangible assets. Machinery and equipment budget is the budget that declines most by 2.7% in real terms. And that might be because the department is cutting down in its goods and services expenditure. Now, in terms of programs, the department is structured into 10 programs. The first 7 programs I'm going to go through very quickly, because those 7 programs collectively spend 35% of the department's budget, whereas you will find that revenue administration, that is transferred to SAS, that's 35% of the budget, so that is more important. In terms of growth, the budget has grown in real terms, and the monetary increase of 2 billion rand is mostly for technical support and development finance. The administration program, which provides strategic leadership, management, and administrative support to the department, the budget has reduced a bit, and most of that budget, because it's administrative, it's the administration of the department, 98% goes to compensation of employees, and 28% of the budget goes to current payments, 51% of which is compensation of employees and operating leases for most of the goods and services budget. Most of the smaller programs, the concern will be the same, under expenditure due to unfilled posts. So the same with program 2, economic policy, tax, financial regulation and research. 76% of the budget is for compensation of employees and 24% for goods and services. Once again, 50% of the goods and services budget goes to consultants and professional services. And the concern there is that there's significant under expenditure due to unfilled vacancies in the legal design tax unit. The department, if they have to consult tax specialists, for example, it would come from the consultant budget of that particular program. Mm-hmm. The third program, which is public finance and budget management, is also a small part of the vote. It provides advice and analysis on fiscal policy, public finances, intergovernmental fiscal relations, and expenditure planning. And the expenditure priorities there are improving provisional financial management, budgeting and expenditure, and once again, unfilled position. The department, the treasury and its entities, and the other votes that come here, they try to capacitate on their own, because they is just a scarce resource as is within the economy itself for those departments. Asset and liability management ensures prudent cash management and an optimal flow of debt and other fiscal obligations. So most of the financial payments within the overall government budget are extended through this program directly through the National Treasury, and they are for the DBSA, for the Land Bank, and they have indicated that these, most of the expenditure for recapitalization of the DBSA and other entities will end up to the 2015-16 financial year. So in that financial year, we will expect a decrease in the budget of this program. Financial accounting and supply chain management, 66% current expenditure, computer services once again, and the international relations program, most of the transfers go to the African Integration and Support Program and the International Development Funding Institutions Program. And there are also transfers to the Common Monetary Area, as well as transfers once again to the to the African Development Bank and the African Development Fund for the replenishment of the African Development Fund. The seventh vote, which takes 14% of the vote program, the vote budget. The expenditure, because it's for and medical contributions, it goes to households. So most of the transfers from that will go towards households. Technical support and development finance, most of the transfers from this program will be for job creation. For example, implementation of the jobs fund, and 38% of the transfers go to provinces and municipalities, and 53% to public enterprises and public corporations in order to ensure that they support technical assistance for capacity building as well as implementing job creation projects. And there's a 41% real growth in terms of this this program. SARS, I will go into when I do the SARS budget analysis. Just for now to say that there has been a reduction on the SARS budget, but the department is not really concerned about that because SARS has accumulated a surplus over the years. So they are confident that if they run out of their budget holes, then they have a surplus to fall back on. Financial intelligence and state security, that's 16% of the vote. They combat financial crime for national security, such as money laundering. That's what they invest in. And most of this budget will be transferred to the South African Secret Services account to combat financial crime. And the comment there is that the department should provide a progress report on the service delivery implementation and performance of the institution, which brings us back to monitoring of the activities of its entities. In terms of the considerations for the committee of what it could bring up when it meets with the department, perhaps the department can provide a broader, a presentation, a progress report on service delivery implementation and performance, and also the department also oversees a lot of entities, and they all deal with funds, lots of funds that are transferred, so monitoring those will be important. And maybe provide a report on how it will fill vacant positions, especially scarce skills. And also the monitoring of the infrastructure investment framework, how will the National Treasury achieve that? That brings me to the end of the National Treasury budget analysis. And I will now go to their program 9, which is SARS, going back to SARS. 35% of Program 9 is transferred entirely to SARS. And SARS aims, its mandate is to ensure optimal compliance with tax and customs legislation, ensure compliance is achieved, and ensure compliance is achieved in the most efficient and cost-effective manner, as well as in a manner that doesn't unduly impede trade and economic growth and development. And in terms of its achievement, SARS has reported that tax compliance on PSUN has increased from 83% in 2012-13 to 84% in 13-14. And the table that you see actually shows that how budget revenue has grown from the last financial year. So there is an increase in tax compliance, but there are also challenges. And the aim of SARS is to support the NDP and social objectives of government, and to ensure a sustainable revenue stream for government. And they've got four core outcomes that they want to achieve, which is to increase tax compliance as well as customs and compliance, to increase and ease fairness of doing business with SARS for business, as well as to increase the cost effectiveness and internal efficiency of its own operations. In terms of the risks, particularly in tax collection, SARS has indicated that there's a growing number of illicit economic activities, such as smuggling and such as the sale of contraband goods and illegal immigration, which have a negative effect and erodes the formal tax base which SARS can collect revenue from. Another issue is the perception of poor state service delivery, which negatively impacts taxpayers' attitudes towards tax compliance. The growing tax evasion, where you find that businesses evade tax to offset the impact of slow economic recovery. And the challenge here is that business is increasingly using complex and sophisticated financial schemes to achieve this, and SARS has to be on top of that. VAT fraud also could increase, and the main thing is that businesses don't really want to lose out on their productivity, and they want to offset the negative impact of the economy on them. The responses to the risks is that by deploying officials to reach all current and potential taxpayers, SARS carries outreach, educational and other compliance activities just to talk to perceptions of people, for example, in terms of complying with tax. They're developing and procuring mobile registration kits, increasing border control activities, and the others. And in terms of its budget, SARS has been allocated 9.7 billion, which is over the medium term, the budget will increase at a nominal rate of 6.1%. And although it's an entity, but it's got its own five programs that it functions with. But the main two are the operation program, which take up the bulk of the program budget. In terms of the operations program, most of the spending is on compensation of employees, and specifically on audit, IT, and tax administration, especially skills, which are critical for us to deliver on this mandate. Spending on consultants is expected. This is what the entity has said. Because they are working on increasing their capacity, they expect that as they increase their capacity, spending on consultants will decrease. And in terms of the issues that the committee can assess is that the issue of vacancies once again, how they should report on progress made with respect to filling the critical skills within the entity. And also in their strategic plan, they've indicated that 20% of senior leadership may potentially be leaving in the next 4 years. And those people will be retiring, or it will be their contracts will expire. If they leave, and most people who have the skills have to retire, I think it's important for the committee to check whether SARS has identified potential successors, and are they working on ensuring skills transfer to younger employees, and just planning for appropriate handover and grooming processes. Another thing is that SARS could regularly update the committee on its risk mitigation strategies pertaining to all identified risks. So this speaks more to continued briefings to the committee and you know, highlighting challenges and successes, but mostly if there's any gap in terms of how SARS, the challenges that SARS faces, then it could brief this committee on a continuous basis. And that is the end of the SARS and National Treasury presentation. SARS-FA is very brief. Maybe we'll just skip the mandate. Suffice to say that the SA, their main focus is perhaps just the budget analysis. I'll go straight to the budget analysis. SARS-FA receives 2.2 billion rand. Their budget increases in both real and nominal terms. And they've got 7 programs that they work from. The administration program receives the largest share of the budget, and followed by statistical collection and outreach. So collectively, these two programs receive 65% of the SA budget. And the 65, most of the budget, 55%, goes to compensation of employees due to the labor-intensive nature of survey activities, as indicated. They need field workers to collect their statistics. The goods and services budget goes to operating leases, computer services, as well as travel and subsistences. It's quite big because of their, they probably have to pay accommodation for some of their field workers. In terms of transfers and subsidies, the budget declined by 14.7% in nominal terms, and capital payments increased in 2014-15, and the bulk of the increase is on the spent on office accommodation, on buildings and fixed structures. The issues that Parliament could raise was that essay, other than them, we haven't really looked at the operational issues due to lack of time. Just broadly, the department had previously reported that they didn't meet some of their performance targets due to the capacity constraints. Just looking at their vacancy rate, the department can look into that, the progress they've made in terms of filling vacancies. And perhaps also provide the committee with details of their staff establishment, skills retention strategies, and similar to SARS, ways in which they ensure skills transfer in case people have to retire or leave, and their plan as to how they plan to fill these critical positions. And that brings me to the end of the presentation. Thank you.
Comments, questions?
Thank you, Chair. And let me welcome the presentation and the analysis as made by the presenter. Chair, I want to check whether the documents that I have here don't speak to the allocations that you are analyzing and other things. I only have the analysis that you were making, but not the actual presentations by those different departments to say this is how you came to analyze based on what they have presented, whether Treasury, SARS, or whoever. So there's supporting documents that one can also go through just to look at how you have analyzed and what they have presented. Thank you. That's the first one. The second one, Chair, if you look at the Treasury presentation, there's one area where they talk of aiming towards tightening control on goods and services and other things. But what the presenter has also made was that somewhere, somehow, they are not consistent in that, and there are reasons for that from time to time. And I think if Treasury wants to get other things right, I mean, if we say let's cut on goods and services, let's cut on travel and subsistence, let's cut on this and that, we have to follow it through, and Treasury must lead by example in terms of that, so that we are able to meet other competing priorities. And I think that's one of the areas we have to be firm about. There's also one interesting area around filling of vacancies, scarce skills, and if you look at the wage bill across the presentations that were made, already it's above 50% or so, and they still say we have rescues, and therefore that's why in the meantime we are using consultants, but we also are underspending on filling vacant posts, and therefore we also fill. So I'm not getting it from the presenter whether looking at the rescues that are that these departments are still running short of, is the structure bloated, or what makes the wage bill to still be high when they still have a lot of vacancies? That's another, because some of these things you should also look at and then be able to raise our concern accordingly. The other issue, Tim, there's also something that you said that the budget of education is decreasing. Did I get it right?
Transfers to higher education.
Oh, transfers to higher education and increase. Okay. Then I didn't get it right. Thank you. The 38% transfers of provinces and municipalities. I may be looking at 38% out of 100%, and looking at the emphasis of the president on prioritizing municipalities during the SONA, whether some of the things that president committed to, will this 38% also speak to that? Are we able to? Because I think once the president says all those things, other things should also follow. So it's one of the things that you can also look at and see whether that will talk to how we prioritizing local government and other related things. The last issue, Chair, is the impact of the budget on civil delivery. I'm not sure when or who does that. I know we have monitoring and evaluation. I know we would look at the 1 trillion budget and all other things, but at the end we must be able to say, even if departments are saying we have managed to live within our means and do whatever, what is the impact of that which we have allocated? Isn't it that we shouldn't be conveyor belts and just say, but we should also be able to say the impact of this to ordinary people? I'm not sure who might do that, but it will be very interesting for us to also look at that going forward. I know it's not relevant for now, but we should have those tools to be able to, as we do, oversight. Thank you.
Source class, and during their presentation will be easy for us to take these particular findings forward. And lastly, I think on the SSA, you know, one of the first thing that you are recommending as the key issue for us to consider as public representatives is to check with the department as to whether they meet their performance targets due to capacity constraints. Were you not able to teach out those performance targets just for the sake of oversight exercise? And were you not able to pick it up in their budget vote or maybe in their strat plan as to how have they performed around those targets, you know, and maybe highlight those targets, because to me it was going to be very helpful if you were saying to us these are the performance targets that were not realized due to the capacity constraints. And our findings these targets are not yet met. I don't know if you are not able to pick up on those performance targets, because it will be easy for us then to make a follow-up with the status. Thank you.
This one thing, Chair, on
SARS.
You know, there's also one interesting thing that you said about SARS, that they will tap on their surplus. Does it mean they don't surrender their money like other departments do towards the end of the budget? Something that I picked up when she made the presentation.
Thank you very much, Chairperson and Honourable Members. Just in terms of the supporting documents, the information, when we do a budget analysis, because it's what the department itself says it's going to do, all the information members could get in the budget, the E&E, the strategic plan, and the annual performance plan. What we normally do is that, and the annual report, except that we didn't have time with staff, as say, like the honorable member has identified, because what the department says they're going to, they get a budget and they say this is what we're going to achieve with the budget, but with the, in their strategic plan, they say exactly how they're going to achieve it. And the annual performance plans normally give you specific smart performance indicators that you can actually measure against their annual report. So, and the analysis would be a consolidated analysis of all those documents, just to check whether the department is doing what they're supposed to be doing, and whether they're doing it how they said they were going to do it. So all that information is in their strategic plans adjusted as the estimates in the E&E. We've got reference lists in the documents where you will find some of the information. The cuts on goods and services, government can effect cuts. It depends on how they're going to affect service delivery. If a cut, for example, Treasury did cut on travel and subsistence. It's the biggest cut in their budget in terms of current expenditure. And probably they can afford to cut on travel and subsistence in a way that will not necessarily compromise their service delivery. In terms of is the structure bloated and what impacts on the wage bill and getting scarce skills. The wage bill is impacted by several things. For example, our country is very much unionized. The wage negotiations of the union, it's not necessarily the hiring and resignations. The inflation will impact on the wage bill. Unions normally expect to negotiate inflation plus one you know, that one represents wealth. But because already we are above inflation, then it will also impact on the wage bill. So there are several factors that impact on the wage bill, as well as the actual vacancy structure. The 38% transfer to provinces and municipalities, these are in addition to the equitable share that is transferred to provinces. There's also, if we were to look at the votes of every single department, we would see that a lot of departments transfer conditional grants to provinces and local governments. So in order to check, we will have to look at the consolidated budget to see what exactly the transfers to local municipalities and municipalities amount to. But certainly, definitely not just this figure that appears in the treasury vote. The other was whether we get the risk. They have been identified by us, actually, and the reason why we pick them up is also precisely that tomorrow when members meet with SARS, then they know exactly what's in their document, exactly what they have presented, and also to identify issues that we can make members aware of that they can ask SARS about. So those are risks that are identified by the agency itself.
The issues we will raise more exhaustively tomorrow when we engage with the entities concerned. My general observation is that it's a good overview, but given some of the issues you raise, the questions you ask about are very much meek almost. And Parliament must exercise rigorous oversight. And ultimately, it's the politicians who decide what we choose to draw from your report, what we choose not to. But it would be nice if the researchers, I mean, if you were a bit more, let's say, assertive, a bit more challenging. Given the quality of what you say, the questions you raise are very much. In other words, you're alerting us, because of the new, to many of the challenges and almost not commensurate with the points you're making and what we know is happening. So can we plead for a bit more rigor? But otherwise, it's very good. Thank you indeed. Over then to the Parliamentary Vice Office people. They've been asked to come here. I hope I don't explain. Just about we met with them, if you like, last week at the induction briefing. So I think that you're aware that we were almost all of us there. What we're really looking for is what exactly do you do, for those of us who are not there mainly, and exactly how do you relate to this committee? And what are some of the issues that you are confronted with, and how do you think this committee might help? Now, we meant to finish at 12:30. That gives us shortly less than 20 minutes. Now, obviously, we have to expand to quarter to one, latest 1 o'clock. Will that be okay? And can I plead with everybody to be a bit more pointed and precise in what we say?
Honourable Chair, honourable members, thank you very much for the opportunity to engage with you a bit more pointedly around what the Vice Office specifically will be able to do for the committee. And I think this is a critical area because I think the Honourable Dan Sangoyan indicated that the Finance and Appropriations Committees in the 2 hours are actually the kind of advisory board to the Budget Office. So in this role, it's going to be an important advisory board in terms of guiding the Budget Office in terms of its work and the outcome of its work that it's going to have to produce. In terms of my presentation, honourable members, I'll look at the legislative mandate, the core functions. We'll look at the organizational structure, the scope, the workflow, and then the reporting lines. And we will be able to discuss on any of these issues that we go. Honorable Chair, I think the point has already been made that the Money Bills Act has created the opportunity for the Parliamentary Budget Office to be established. Section 15 specifically talks about the establishment of a budget office. And the aim of this budget office is to provide independent, objective, professional advice and analysis to Parliament on specific issues, Chair, which are related to the budget and any other money bills. So really, I think it's important to note that there's a distinction here between the work of the budget office and the work of content advisors and research. And I think the two reports that went there were actually very good, and the research and the content advisors definitely have a role to play in terms of supporting the committee in this regard. I'm not sure, Section 15, again, as I say, outlines the core functions of the PBO. And again, honourable members, the implementation of the money bills is important, and the Act is important. And here, the Budget Office will provide you with the support in terms of looking at annual reviews and analysis of the documentation tabled in Parliament by the Executive in terms of the Act. So any of the documentation that has been tabled in terms of money bills, you can, as a committee, request the Budget Office to do the necessary analysis and assessment. And I think Honourable Chair, you were quite right in indicating the issue around the rigorous analysis, which is critical in this respect. Also, providing advice and analysis on proposed amendments, specifically with regard to the fiscal framework, the division of revenue, and other money bills and policy issues related to this area. So, Honourable Chair, the point we've made here is that, again, there will be specific pieces of work that emanate from the discussion of the committee, finance committee, relating to the division of revenue, whether it be the fiscal framework, any other money bills that you would want to have investigated, and the committee would want to take a decision and an opinion on. So again, this is where the budget office will be supportive to you in this regard. Honourable Chair, the next core function is to look at monitoring and synthesizing of issues that were tabled to the House that have budgetary implications. So again, the committee can ask for an assessment or analysis in this regard. I just picked up, Chair, as we were going through the discussion, one of the issues that was raised in the committee now, specifically the issue around tax and revenue generation, and some of the issues that could be asked to start in this respect. So one of the key issues would be, in terms of your capacity, in terms of your analysis, in terms of your money, is this contributing to revenue generation? Is tax law? And what portion of taxation is it, personal or company taxation, that is critical for revenue generation in the country? So I think these are some of the rigorous analysis that you could ask for in this regard. Honourable Chair, the other issues, honourable members, is for us to keep you abreast of policy debates and developments, especially as it relates to expenditure and revenue. The monitoring and reporting of unfunded mandates arising out of the legislative policy and budgetary proposals, and in undertaking any other work that the committee deems the budget office should undertake, whether it be a specific area of research or policy or costing in this respect, this is where the budget office will potentially be of assistance to you. Honourable members, in terms of the structure, as I've indicated, the budget office is not a big structure. If it's once it's fully staffed, it will be about 12 people. And I know you wanted to raise the issue of vacancies, which is not really a critical issue, because vacancies in this regard is about how we get the right people to fill the posts. The only three posts that are still needed to be filled is the deputy directors, and we're in the process of headhunting to bring in the right people in this regard. We now have successfully filled in all the analyst positions. So this is where we stand with respect to the organizational structure.
In terms of the scope, Honorable Chair, next slide. Again, I think I've covered this before, but just to indicate that the functions here, Honorable Chair, will emanate from the committee, from the Finance and Appropriations Committee. It's critical to understand here, Honorable Members, that the work of the Budget Office is demand-driven. It comes from you as a committee. So we don't sit out there and do our own kind of work and thinking and research which is not of use to you. It is demand-driven from this committee in this regard. So it's going to be up to us sitting with you in these committees and my colleagues to identify the kind of areas of support that you can and will require in this regard. So it is important to note that one point. Chair, again, what we're currently focusing on, and this is part of some of the areas that we try to strengthen, we will produce two reports every year, very brief reports, which we refer to as the Policy, Economic and Fiscal Review Reports, which will provide a kind of basis for understanding the implications of the broad policy, economic and fiscal trends undergoing in the South African environment. It is not the type of report that Esther, for example, presented, which was a good report, or that Bridget presented, but it will be a kind of report which will indicate some of the implications to the fiscal framework and the budget process. We will also, as I say, indicate specific reports on research topics that the committee would advise. One of the areas, Honorable Chair, and I think you did make mention of this and touch on it, is the issue of public participation, which is a critical issue which we believe has not been happening. And we want to encourage this through, for example, a product which we're delivering now, which we refer to as a stakeholder survey. So we want to go out there, test the views of business, labor, communities, NGOs, and give them a voice as well in terms of their opinion, in terms of the budget, in terms of monetary policy, in terms of fiscal policy, in terms of inputs to this community, to this committee, which I think is important on both here. And I think for too long we just hear about National Treasury's views or, you know, the Budget Office, or I think you need to understand what the views of other NGOs are out there, what labor is saying, the assumptions, the reasons for it, so that you are able to make appropriate decisions in this regard. Honorable Chair, another area is capacity building for members of Parliament. Now, this will be either in the forms of us assisting you with undertaking, and I think Honorable Desa Noyer also mentioned it, is the issue of specific training courses which we can facilitate. It's just engaging with the Budget Office as well as the committee, and us taking you through some of the areas of analysis. So we will try and focus on these areas. And a critical area as well is for us to collaborate with other structures of Parliament. And the Act does say that we will support the researchers and content advisors where required in this regard. And again, the decision and the demand will be undertaken by you as a committee. Honourable Members, just to give an indication of how the workflow takes place, the work will be identified by the four committees, two in the NCLP, two in the NA, Finance and Appropriations. So the work is considered by this committee. It is agreed as a committee that this is the specific type of work that you want the Budget Office to do. It will then be submitted via a request from the chairperson to the director and, of course, through to the executive authority, which is the speaker and the chair of the NCLP. This will then specifically be undertaken by the TBO and then submitted back to the chair of the committee or by the chair of the committee in terms of the work and analysis undertaken. The reason for this, Honourable Members, is to ensure that there's independent advice, nonpartisan advice that is provided to the committee that is freely and openly available and transparent, and that the committee can then undertake its necessary decision-making abilities. So this is the potential work for Honourable Chair, which all four committees will undertake in this regard. An important issue, I think, Honourable Chair, addressed is the next slide, which looks at the reporting line. And the Act specifically indicates that the PBO reports to the Executive Authority, which is the Chair and the Speaker of the NCLP. However, there is also a filler between the PBR and the executive authority, and I think Honourable Desta-Goyen indicated it. It comprises of the chair of the House Chair of the National Assembly and the four chairs of the Finance and Appropriation Committees in the two houses. And this team acts as an advisory board to the Budget Office and also as an advisory board to the Executive Authority, which is the chair and the speaker of Parliament. So I think this committee, Honourable Chair, needs to be revived. We have raised the issue with Honourable Flory, to ensure that, you know, he calls together this meeting comprising of the four chairs, Finance and Appropriations. And again, this also relates to the issue that there are certain areas of the Act which needs to be amended. The one thing specifically is the issue around the timing of budget inputs and how that will be addressed. And there are other issues related to textual amendments or reporting lines, etc. So these things are far on the way already. The last Finance Committee unfortunately could not address these amendments, and I think Honourable Desta-Goyen will bear me out on this, that the new Finance Committee is now expected to take this up and lead the drive in this regard. That basically, Honourable Chair, is the role of the Budget Office and the role that we will be supporting and playing to the Finance Committee in this regard, and also the Appropriations Committee in this respect. Thank you, Chair.
Your colleague on behalf.
If I may just introduce my colleague, our economist, Rashad Amra, who hails from National Treasury. We have Mr. Brandon Alves, who was a researcher in Parliament. Dr. Makula Sekatan, who is our policy advisor and was previously head of economics at Fox University. And we have Ms. Miriam Orlandi, who comes from Provincial Treasury and has had extensive experience in budget analysis. We've appointed two more analysts, Honourable Chair, who will be joining us on the 1st. They've actually started, but I think they're on induction. We are in the process now, also, Chair, of looking at filling the vacancies for the Deputy Directors, and then the team will be full. Thank you, sir.
Yeah, Ben,
induction
for them to appear on their first day as well before this horrible committee. Which will frighten them. All right, fine. Over to members. Any comments, questions?
Thank you, Chairperson. Thanks very much for the presentation. It is very pleasing to see that the office is finally taking off. I recall when we wrote the Act, we also had in mind, and I think it was certainly ended up in the Act, was that there would be a service also provided to members of Parliament. My question is this: if, for example, a member is working on something for a private member's bill, for example, and there is some kind of an economic bent to it, would they be able to get support of some kind from the Budget Office? Thanks, Chair.
I'm not asking the question. I wanted to make a recommendation on maybe some of the things which. Parliamentary budget should look into the. I know there's a committee on tax review thing by run by Judge Davis. I think that maybe we need to partition some of the things that must be looked into there, particularly with regards to corporate tax, because there is a phenomenon not only in South Africa but in the whole continent of transfer pricing by particularly the natural resources extractors and everything else. I think we need to pay attention to that. I think South Africa is victim of that phenomenon because what we have is the whole mining sector, which is supposed to be the biggest in the whole world, only contributes about 20-25 billion to the national fiscus. But 25 billion cannot fund education of KZN only. only the KZN. So the whole Women's Center can fund education, primary and high school, not universities. So we need to look into that if we're not there isn't lot of profit shifting and all these other things that is happening there. Well, we appreciate the comment which Jay Davis is leading, but we need to look into the process as well as Parliament of what is happening there. Because I think there's lots of innovation that is characterizing the whole system, and we need to take action as soon as possible. So that is a concrete recommendation that we're making sure.
Maybe it's just me, and I need more time to kind of that. But I'm not utterly clear. In fact, it's inevitable. The blurring of lines of work between the PBO and the content supplier and research. I'm not absolutely clear that the rules are distinctly carved as they should be. And maybe that's invariable, inevitable. I don't know. Secondly, our interests. You know, I haven't struck me that why not? You have a role in capacity building. So as we shape our program, and as we become clear about what our needs are, we will be very keen to actually draw you into a role in helping us to capacity ourselves, not just you, but other parties as well. Thirdly, it's not just for us to identify. What I wanted to ask is, do you send a representative to every meeting of the standing committee? If you do, then it makes it easier. You can, looking at what we say, I mean, listening to what we say, getting a sense of where we're at, decide that actually these are some issues that might be of value to us. So it's actually also, I think, your responsibility to identify to us the chair or the group here or whoever, or the committee as a whole, right? I'm pleased to see that you're saying that we should look at the Act, the Moneyball Act, as it's called, and that Mr. Frolic should convene that meeting. I think you're right. I was doing any case in him, and I will do so, based on what Piers van der Weyden said earlier. I think, though, we should revive the committee after the EPT. I think we've got a bit of a rush of things to do in the next week and a half, so soon after then, I would imagine we could meet. The thing also I should mention. Well, I'll come back to that in my concluding comments, which won't be long, actually. But for now, could you respond very discreetly to the issues raised by all of you? Thank you. Thank you, Honorable Chair. Honorable Chair, I think the first question raised by Honorable George is the issue around support to individual members of Parliament. I think initially this was an intention when the study was to look at various models of parliamentary budget offices across the world. And some of the areas that they looked at was Japan, Korea, the US, Canada, who all have their own budget offices here. And Korea, for example, you have a staff of over 1,000 people, and they provide support to individual members of parliament. So an individual MP can walk into the budget office and say, we need you to do this work for us, and they'll do it. In South Africa, we have 54 committees, 12 people that can't fly at this stage. So what the decision was from the previous group of our principals, politicians, was that we'll start with the four finance and appropriation committees of parliament, and we'll provide the support to them and see how this goes. And if there's a necessity, this group of chairs of the Finance and Appropriation Committees together with the House Chair will decide how we roll it out maybe to the other 50 committees of Parliament, which could be more now, Honorable Chair. Or, and then later on, see how we could potentially roll it out to individual members of Parliament in this regard. You are right, Chair, at this stage, you know, there was a bit of a clearing of lines between research, content advisors, and the budget office. However, I think there's a clear distinction in terms of the function that the budget office will provide in terms of assisting you, firstly, I think, with addressing the issue of the amending and the issue relating to Moneyball's amendment. So the aim of the budget office, Honorable Chair, is not to do the kind of research
to have researchers and without a takeaway in that capacity. But when necessary, we will support and assist and improve some of the capacity. All the work of content advisors will look at more the kind of sectoral content analysis. The aim of the budget office, Honourable Chair, is, as I say, comes back to the issue around money votes and amendments in this regard. So, are you looking, for example, at costing of certain policies or bills that come in? What's the financial implications? Which you never find, Honourable Chair, in this regard. What are the issues around revenue generation and potential debt implications for the budget office? Some of the areas here that, you know, could just come up. And you're quite right here, we do send a letter to every committee, especially the Finance and Appropriations Committee. And the rep will be there to advise you in terms of what specific pieces of work can be undertaken. I think the point Honourable Chivanku makes is an excellent piece of idea in terms of the potential that the budget office can undertake. The only thing we ask for, Honourable Chair, is that it should be a decision of the committee that this is a piece of work that will be undertaken. And that we are allowed, you know, to develop the terms of reference for it and then provide it to, in the interest of, you know, independence, non-partisanship, etc. I hope that's addressed out the areas of
course. Okay, is there anything else before we draw to a close? Yeah.
Thanks once more, Chair. Maybe to amplify the request made by Honorable Shibambo. In our last report to the House on the budget speech, that is the last budget speech of the fourth Parliament, we picked up that some of the Davis Commission recommendations and reports have found their way, in fact, into the Minister's speech. And as a collective, we then agreed, the collective, I'm referring to the committee, we then agreed that there is a need for us to be taken on board about the progress made here by the Health Commission, because really it caught us flat-footed that some of these recommendations were only highlighted during the budget speech. So I think as we deal with this whole issue of the work done by the Davis Commission, let's look into that committee recommendations, I mean, to make sure that we address all the areas of what they are doing. Thank you.
So you've been implying that the PDO will be asked to begin to look at it?
Of course. Of course.
Right.
Okay. So already the committee
will
look at that, yeah.
All right, here this is one topic already. Sorry.
Chairperson, if we put issues to be looked into on the agenda, I would like to add something, but do you think it's the appropriate time in terms of the factors inhibiting investment in South Africa? And I would really like to know whether, if I may address the professor, whether this would also be appropriate for the budget office to look into, and what is the current percentage of investment and how it could be increased, and what are those factors inhibiting investment? And if we as a committee can also give that to the Parliamentary Budget Office, that would be most helpful, especially if we go into debate in terms of the importance of investments or not, and we can have an independent opinion from the Parliamentary Budget Office. I think that would be helpful.
Responses to that before we ask the Professor to reply.
So for order to traditionally ask that we get to listen to the Davis Tax Commission, or what are the concrete recommendations you're speaking to, so that we can appraise ourselves. I know there's work in the Country Parliament there will be, so that we can then deal with the details of some of the issues that there. And we don't trample on the same line that has been covered with the PBO deals with the process. I don't know if there will be time, Chair, to listen to what the commission that we then will be able to take it from there.
It depends. I don't know, sorry Gabby, I don't know exactly who this commission is answerable to, where its work is it within the executive domain, it's work being processed. There are some rules and guidelines that define how far Parliament
how we crafted our recommendation. Our recommendation was to the National Treasury to take us on board about the report that has been presented to them by the Davis Commission, because as I said, it really shocked us, I mean, to realize that some of the recommendations were at the implementation stage, and as a committee, we were not briefed about the outcome of that commission. So we are not like putting emphasis on the commission coming to parliament, because again, we didn't touch into, we didn't get into that space of what is there. I mean, it's not really put into, but we were focusing on our mandate as a committee that is responsible, I mean, for holding National Treasury accountable. And so that's how we talk about.
He will raise this tomorrow with the Treasury to ask where is this commission and to what extent have you begun to implement its recommendations and why. How about that? Then on the issue of what I don't want is a shopping list, a clustering of, you know, everybody wants an issue, CBO do it, without like an overall like strategic approach. But, you know, I think that the general point you've made about effectively it is not you start some work on that. But beyond that, now I don't want a shopping list. Not everybody's going to come up and put their hand up and they're able to talk to friends. CBO do it. I would like to look at why we, the World Proletarian Revolution, has been triumphed in 1924. Right, so, you know, and then what are we going to end up with? So let's be a bit careful about how we manage our tasks to the CBO. Moreover, we just want our full genetics. And I am engaging informally with the other chairs. For now, I think the broad sort of topics that are given to you, you can begin work on. We will, as we evolve over the next 6 weeks, be clear about precisely the terms of the things we see and what exactly we want you to actually look at. In the meanwhile, the two people concerned, if you want to write one page or something and bring to the committee, we can look into that. Yes.
Thank you, Chairperson. I just wanted to raise the point about, as you said, about the shopping list. We certainly don't want one. And I think that there are two areas here that we're talking about today. One is a sort of broader economic issue relating to, well, why is our economy not growing and what about attractiveness to investment, etc. And so kind of a macro issue. And then the issue of transfer pricing. We did have quite a lot of debate in the committee when I was on the committee during the taxation laws amendment process, where it was, I think, of Section 45 of the Income Tax Act, where it was suspended because there was concern regarding that. It's a very technical issue, I think. I think we must treat it as that. It's a very technical issue that needs to be looked at. There's obviously something wrong in the tax law regarding that, and that's why it's being gamed, and I think that's the problem. That's why it's going that way, obviously it's happening that way. But I think that they're quite wide, the two topics are very wide, and I think we must be clear when we give instruction to the budgetary office is that if we have capacity in our own research to maybe look into details such as that, technical details, then we should do that. But it's just a comment I wanted to put there that this terrain has been travelled on a little bit in the past. Thanks, Jim.
Yeah, no, I think we excuse me. That being said, can we draw to a close? I just want to make a few comments very quickly. One is that our researcher, is getting maternity leave shortly in the front. So we wish you well. And let's meet you. And remember, the name Eunice is gender neutral. It can be a male or a
to make it clear, I'm coming here exactly 1 minute to 10. Anybody looking for me only looks for me if I'm not here within 60 seconds of the time the meeting is going to be. Right? Those of you who want to come and sit here from 8:30, that's your democratic right. My generation fought for the democracy so that you can have the right to come and sit here at 8 o'clock, or not 10 o'clock. But on a more serious note, 10 to 5, okay? And I think those of you who are shaping the report, I can tell you now the introduction has to be, this is a unique period, and the committee wants to immediately say that we were not able, within the time of another constraint, to exercise the rigorous oversight we were preferred. That's your first paragraph already, right? And that we therefore will come back to some of these issues during the year, and we are providing upon an ongoing rigorous oversight. So that's our introduction. Let's not pretend that we're going to be able to do what Parliament requires of us in these circumstances. And it doesn't matter which party we run, we are Parliament. When I was in the executive, no difference, I used to plead with the committee sometimes to be more rigorous. It is in the interest of the executive. Let me get up in PMG minutes. I appeared as a deputy minister of Cox. And the Minister of Communications. So I'm not saying anything different. I said, it is in the interest of the executive that the parliamentary committees are strong and effective and rigorous in their oversight. I said it before 2009. I said it while I was a member of the executive in two capacities, and I'm repeating that. We are an organ of people's power. We are answerable to the people out there. The fact that it's an ANC minister doesn't mean that because we are in the ANC, we might just submit meekly. I'm alerting my own comrades to that. That's not the way it works. We must conform to the requirements of the Constitution for Parliament to be rigorous in its oversight. So I'm being very clear. We must be very clear in our first paragraph that we aren't able to do what we're supposed to do. But within our constraints, that we can. So I look forward to working with you. I thank you very much for your cooperation. I especially want to convey my sincerest thanks to the team here, who very quickly pulled all of this together and did a very good job, very encouraging, which is why I